All right, well, I think we'll get started here. My name is Daniel Rothberg. I'm a reporter with the Nevada Independent. I cover environmental issues, and I cover a lot of water-related issues. And I'm really excited for this panel because I think one of the main themes that I write about and comes up in a lot of my water reporting is kind of incorporating 21st century values into a system that was created in the 19th century. They say a lot in water. We have 19th century water law, 20th century infrastructure, 21st century climate. And I think, I think that's one of the things we're going to be focusing on in the panel today, is kind of looking at how to incorporate social and environmental issues into a water law that is kind of embedded, that has this sort of private, in many cases, there are more private rights to use water than there is water to go around as a baseline in, you know, watersheds across the West. So kind of thinking about the laws, policy, tools that can be used to incorporate environmental flows and water rights to ensure that communities have access to drinking water and to their water rights. I shared a link to a document in the Hoova app about kind of Western water law, and it's very complex and complicated, and we're probably not going to go through, we'll be talking about some of those themes, but in general, there in the West, we use a system of prior appropriation, where those who got rights to use water first, in theory, are the most protected in times of shortage. They're the last to be cut off. And those who claimed water later are the first to be cut off. The law is not actually applied that way in many cases, but that is sort of the general rule. Water also has to be put to beneficial use, which is kind of a term that we might be talking about a little bit, what is actually a beneficial use. And you have to use your water or you risk forfeiting your water. So this is sort of the theoretical framework for water rights. This is not actually how water is, how water is regulated in many cases, because policymakers are hesitant to actually cut off people's water rights. So there's a complicated tension there. But we really want to kind of focus on the tension between private water rights and some of these social and environmental considerations. And we have an awesome panel to talk about all these things today. We have Marie Calloway-Kellner, who's a conservation program director at the Idaho Conservation League. She holds a JD from the University of Idaho College of Law with a focus on water policy. And I'm particularly excited as somebody who is in Nevada and doesn't get to make it out to Idaho as often as I'd like, and there's a lot more water here, to hear about some of the issues that are being discussed in Idaho. To her left, we have Leah Larson, who is the water and land use reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. And she has done a fantastic job reporting on the Great Basin, Salt Lake in particular, which I think is the Great Basin in general. I'm biased as somebody who's based in Reno. It's a very undercovered region with a lot of water stress related issues. And as I think everybody's seen with photos of the Great Salt Lake, the Great Basin, nothing drains out to the ocean, and it all stays in the Great Basin. So you really see the impacts of overuse and over-appropriation, and this idea that there are more rights to use water than there is water going around. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about her reporting. And then to her left, we have Heather Tanana, who is assistant professor of law and Wallace Stegner Research Center fellow at the University of Utah. She focuses on the intersection of environmental issues and health policy with a particular focus on tribal water rights. And she's also the lead author of a report that was released in 2021 by the Colorado River Water and Tribes Initiative that looked at access issues to clean drinking water for tribes in the Colorado River Basin. And I think because the Colorado River has been in the news so much over the last year, and they are directly dealing with this tension of kind of our existing water rights system and it not really being adequate for in many ways, the values and issues that we face today, and kind of the tension of there not being enough water to go around. So I'm really looking forward to hearing your comments as well. And I will get done talking and let everyone sort of make an opening statement and talk a little bit about their work.
Well, good morning, everyone. As Daniel said, my name is Marie Calloway-Kellner, and I'm with the Idaho Conservation League. And in case anyone hasn't done it, I know many of you in the room are from Boise in Idaho, but welcome to Idaho. If you haven't been officially welcomed yet, it's such an extraordinary opportunity for Idaho in general to have this group visiting and seeing this environment. And I know that yesterday was a really big day with field trips. Many of my colleagues at the Conservation League got to go out and be part of different experiences, and I think it just really highlights all that's going on in the state that still doesn't have 2 million people, but is two-thirds publicly owned and a gigantic state. And all the issues Daniel's talking about are very real here. And we get to cover a little bit about me and the Conservation League. So the Idaho Conservation League is 50 years old this year. It was founded by through grassroots people all over Idaho that wanted to have a voice in the legislature for clean water was one of the primary founding principles, and then also responsible management, conservation-minded management of the public lands. And so here we are 50 years later. ICL has four offices around the state. The furthest north is up in Sandpoint near the Canadian border, and then in Ketchum, which is also Sun Valley area, and then in McCall, which I think some folks maybe got to visit yesterday on a field trip, where I understand my colleague Jonathan, we are teasing him and hoping that he didn't talk people's ears off when we understand that the bus got stuck. But he's really good like that and has a lot of information in case you were on the road. But at any rate, I came to ICL about almost 12 years ago now. And that was after going to the University of Idaho College of Law, which I found because it had the U of I up in Moscow had an interdisciplinary graduate program looking at water. And it was called the Waters of the West. And I'm not a scientist. I'm fascinated by science. I always have been. I've never been a good student of it. And I realized that the law was a way in which I might be able to do what I really wanted to do, which was advocate for rivers. And I came before law school. I was a teacher for many years, and I also was a commercial river guide. I grew up in Cleveland, Tennessee. I'm sure a lot of people have heard it. We call it the other Cleveland, but it's down in the corner of Tennessee where North Carolina and Georgia and Tennessee come together. And it is in an area that gets about five times the amount of rain that we get here in Idaho, in southern Idaho. Lots of creeks and rivers, and I was just really fortunate to grow up like kids that might grow up here in the Treasure Valley near the Payette River, less than an hour away. I grew up near a river called Yopoy and started working there as a guide, working for an outfitter and then a guide through high school and college and most of my 20s. And that led me to work on rivers around America. And I ended up in Southeast Alaska working on some rivers, and two of the ones I got to work on were emblematic of a lot of what ICL deals with and a lot of what we all see day in and day out, which is a battle between extraction of natural resources and preservation. Worked on rivers called the Tatshishimi Alsek rivers. And these were where you go out for like 2 weeks and spend time in the backcountry and experiencing these places. And it had been proposed to be the largest open pit copper mine on Earth, or at least that's how it was touted. And it's now the United Nations World Heritage Site. And so after getting to like experience that and spend time in a place and realize some people came together and wouldn't be quiet until this place got protected, that inspired me to go back to school, found the U of I, found the water policy program, was fortunate to be here in Boise, clerking for a judge after law school when the Idaho Conservation League was expanding its program and got a position called the Water Associate. And while ICL had always worked on water quality, it really hadn't been so much in the conversation of quantity, so how we use water, that's water rights. Here in Idaho, water is, and we can talk about this more later, but water is managed separately at the state level. Water quality is managed by the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality. Water quantity is managed by the Idaho Department of Water Resources. That is a, it's sort of like a built-in administrative conflict, frankly, in how water gets used a lot here in Idaho. But my job was to see what could be done to be a voice for responsible water use and also in-stream flows, and I hope we'll talk about that some too as we get going. And then about 4 years ago, I had the opportunity to become the conservation program director. So now I work with our whole staff. There are about a dozen of us that do the conservation, the programmatic work. And we have, I'll just quickly say our four campaigns. Our overarching campaign is a carbon neutral Idaho. So that's really focused on transportation, energy use, and some on ag, which is the biggest user of water in Idaho, agriculture. Our Snake River campaign is about the mid-snake in southern Idaho. So if you go from around Pocatello, south where we are now, over the border with Oregon, there's over upstream of Pocatello, you've got world-class trout streams, an unbelievable river people come from all over the world to see. And by the time it gets over to the Hell's Canyon complex of dams on the border with Oregon, it's heavily polluted. It gets to the point where we get toxic algae outbreaks every summer. You can't get in the river, you can't get in the lakes, it's dangerous. There's a lot of pollution between them. So we have a campaign seeking to make it swimmable and fishable again, words that come straight out of the Clean Water Act. And we also have our salmon campaign. We're trying to help restore healthy and harvestable amounts of wild salmon to central Idaho. And then our final big campaign is our public lands campaign, which is really looking at sort of like landscape level preservation of public lands. And as I said earlier, 2/3 of Idaho is public lands. It's about 60% federally owned and about 5 or 6% state owned, which is a tremendous amount. So lots of natural resource related projects, including recreation, also happening on those lands. So with that, I'll
I'm Leah Larson, and I am the only one on the water lot panel without a background law. I'm a reporter at the Sunday Tribune, and I started my journalism career at this teeny tiny paper called the Sky High News at the headwaters of the Colorado River. So that was quite an education in water alone. You learn being up there that from the moment that river essentially forms, it's diverted and used. Grow our cities and just very overtapped. Kind of I'm familiar with the urban and rural divide these water issues can create. And then about a decade ago, I returned to my home state, Utah, which is the second driest state in the nation after Nevada. And I had spent most of my career covering the Great Salt Lake. So even 10 years ago, biologists, people familiar with the lakes, had a problem. They were trying to sell me alarm all those years ago. Then 2 years ago, it hit a record low, and so lawmakers finally started paying attention, I can say, and started looking at our water laws and how to overhaul them, because if the Great Salt Lake dries up, not only are we facing like an economic disaster, because it provides a lot of money to the state in the form of mineral harvesting, ranch harvesting, tourism, but it's also this looming public health disaster. It's the dust, like the dust, and we're already dealing with that fallout we have for a while. And then, of course, it is a stop oversight for millions of migrating birds, so we're looking at ecological collapse. It could be pretty bad. Like I mentioned, lawmakers have been kind of overhauling our pioneer era water law to get water to this lake in this unique system, because, like Daniel said, our water in the Great Basin doesn't flow to the sea, it only leaves through evaporation, which is why we have this big salty lake. And then about a year ago, a bunch of our newspapers and TV stations and some of our universities formed this thing called the Great Salt Lake Collaborative, where we write our stories and they're free to everyone, and they publish them to their neighbors or other TV station, no paywall. So that's really done a lot to raise public awareness about these environmental issues, I would say. And it's got a lot of lawmakers to pay attention to as well and experiment with our policy. And one of the big reporting projects we did as a collaborative that led to move to California on the other side of the Great Basin to Owens Lake and Mono Lake, just to see what kind of solutions maybe we could explore. So Mono Lake, well, Owens Lake, the biggest source of human-caused pollution, dust pollution in the nation. That's only about a tenth the size of the Great Salt Lake, so it kind of shows us what we, like, the worst-case scenario at the lake, right? So we went there, and we also went to Mono Lake, which is heading the same direction as Owens Lake. But the law and lawsuits, environmental groups fought back, and they established, like, a mandated elevation for that lake. So kind of exploring some of those solutions to see if they might apply.
Well, yate bene everyone, so I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and that's where my personal drive and work all stems from, and we'll see if it will work from here. Just to share some images, those on the left, those are not my great ancestors. That's my dad in the hat and his sibling, and then a couple of my uncles and auntie there right next to them. That's my family. And my nephew there giving you the stink eye, and my aunt Diane and my other niece there. I was born on the Navajo Reservation on the Utah portion in Montezuma Creek, and had my younger years on the res. We lived in Tuba City, we lived in Rindo Rock because my father, who's Dene, my mom, Shana, is Delagana, so European descent on my mother's side. If you're ever talking to an Navajo, ask them who their clans are, right? Because that's going to ground them and relate to them. And so my clans are the Kia'ani, the Towering House, and the Sinajini, the Blackstreet Woods people. And my dad is really the one who drove my career and just was like my superhero. And again, I always tear up when I talk about these things, so you'll get used to that too if we ever talk again in the future. Because it's so personal when you're talking to an Indigenous person. Like, they can't, you know, everything that's led up today, like, oh, it was, you know, the HIV rates, the suicide rates. From someone outside, it's really easy to look at those numbers. You're not connected to it. But for Indigenous people in this country, the number is their family, right? That was my aunt that died of diabetes because she couldn't get the basic care that everybody else had. She shouldn't have passed away at 50. That was treatable, right? And we all have stories like that. And for me, it's very much grounded in water and why I started my career to the tribal water work that I'm engaged in now. So again, going back to my dad, who's a physician, first of his family to go to college and dedicated his entire career to the healthcare of Native people. So we worked and lived on the reservation in the New Rock City, different clinics. And then he was called to IHS headquarters, which some people may know is in Rockville, Maryland. And that was a big change for us. And like this total different environment. And it wasn't until I moved that I realized the rest of the world does not look like Navajo Nation, right? The green, every time I go back still, I'm just like blinded by green, right? And the land is so wet, and the wealth and the resources that are available there are not what my family on the reservation still today have. I still have family members who are water haulers, you know, who don't have, even if they have a water line coming in, they don't have a water heater, right? Or reliable electricity, and they're struggling with bills and things like that. And this map, during the pandemic, there was a group that came together, Navajo Nation, Indian Health Services, and others, and they put this map up on this website, NavajoSoupWater.org, identifying the homes that do not have any piped water coming onto Navajo Nation. And again, you know, why is that the case? Like, how in the world do 30 to 40% of Navajo residents not have water, and other similar arid areas like Phoenix do? And it's very much rooted in federal laws and policies. And that's what drove me to take my path not into medical school anymore, you know, but instead into the law. Because like my dad, I wanted to uplift and impact my community. And so this has been the bulk of my work the past several years. Like was mentioned, being mentioned, I lead the Universal Access to Clean Water project that right now is kind of technically under the umbrella of the Water and Tribes Initiative. And then my own personal research is focused on climate change impacts and things like that, right? on the Water Chapter Team National Climate Assessment, and keep an eye out when it comes out, because another map, and I'm not giving anything secret away here, because there was a line when it went out for public comment, but there's going to be a map in there that IHS hasn't ever publicly put out before, and going not just for Navajo Nation, but broader out to the United States. Navajo is not the only one with water insecurity issues. It's across the basin, it's across the U.S., huge challenge up in Alaska. And so another area kind of that this has led into is water is about everything, right? For anyone who's tried to cover Arizona versus Navajo Nation, right, they're like, what is this case about? Some people are like, it's climate change, the reduced supply, that's what it's about. No, it's tribal water rights, because if the tribes develop their rights, it's going to be taken from the states. And then other people are saying, no, this case is about federal responsibility, the obligation that they have to tribal nations rooted in treaty and trust. And it's a bit of all of those, right? And you know, we can get into it later if anyone else outside, but what I really think the case should be narrowed and focused on. But Colorado River, oh my gosh, like other areas of the country, over-appropriated, right? The number of different species that rely on that system beyond the 40 million people, right? This is an extensive system that is failing. And in large part because of the laws and policies that we've implemented have contributed to the situation. And I wanted to share, I thought that Chris and partnership with High County News did a really great coverage of the story. And because it's a complicated topic to explain to people. When you try and just talk about the law of the river and what are the interests in the river, and they put together these images that that were really great. So I just wanted to share it as an example. When this story came out, it was like, great job of taking like these complex issues and narrowing it down into an image that people can look at and help them understand. And so just the basin, right? Where is the basin? Where are these tribes and location? It showed the land. I think, and again, I'll, you know, you'll hear two numbers out there. 29, 30 tribal nations. The reason people say 29 sometimes is because San Juan Southern Paiute does not have their own land base, and water rights typically are tied onto tribal reservation lands because of the Winters Doctrine, but there's 30 tribes, right? And the San Juan Southern Paiute who reside on basically like Navajo land, they're using water, so, and anyway, we can, there's so many different sightings, right? And they have an agreement with Navajo that they were supposed to get land, the Congress hasn't approved it, like, that just shows the different complexities. I encourage you to say there's 30 tribes. And I think most people have been doing that now. And then the other thing, I think this one was looking at tribal water usages because, right, generally speaking, the tribal water rights are going to come out of the apportionment of the states. And I think this was looking at Arizona's and maybe New Mexico's about what a significant portion that is of the tribe of the state interest, so you can understand why there's these increased tensions when tribes are wanting to access and utilize the rights. And then this was kind of going to what Reactor I mentioned earlier, right, about agriculture being a huge use of water. Like, what's our water going to? I thought that was a great image as well. And particularly this capturing the notion at the same time of the tribal water rights that are not being utilized. So I think those are the ones I wanted to share. So I thought that part of the challenges reporters are having is these issues are complex. I'm rambling right now because it's hard to narrow things down into a single sentence, right? And they're like, what's the most important thing you want people to know? And I'm like, I don't know. Sorry, you know, vote, so I don't know. Like, it's a challenging, and I think that's the hardest thing for reporters. It's talking to your expert contents, and sometimes helping us too. Like, and please, I do not mind when you take up my gums or make me sound more eloquent than I am. That's what other connections I think you might have when you're talking with maybe some indigenous folks where they're like, oh, you're going to quote me verbatim, and that's not, you know, there's that can be some of the, anyway, hesitancy. But again, just, I think you have amazing experts out in the field who know this, and taking that time to get it, your job then is to get it to the people who can understand it, and again, that, I thought that story did a good job of that. So, I'll leave it at that.
There's so, I'm like trying to think of what questions I have. There's so, I mean, we could talk about
2 or 3 hours probably about all these things. But one thing I'm really curious, because you mentioned the Navajo Nation case that's in front of the Supreme Court. Lena mentioned some of the Mona Lake litigation, and that was really pivotal in California around the Public Trust Doctrine. So, you know, one thing I'm really interested in is, like, we have this base foundational water law prior appropriation in theory. Doesn't always work the way that it's written. And I should acknowledge every watershed is different, every state is different, there are different kind of specific laws in each state. So we are over probably generalizing here a little bit. But one thing I'm very curious about is, like, are there legal mechanisms in place that can, are the legal mechanisms that are in place adequate to kind of correct some of the mistakes of the past that are embedded in these private water and private appropriations? I know it's a very complicated question.
No.
Well, I guess. I guess if they're not, like, what do you see sort of on the ground as the path forward for, I guess I'm kind of curious if each of you could kind of talk about maybe what you're seeing in each state about how you actually go about kind of trying to, and I know it's probably different for each of the things you're working on, but trying to carve out space in this existing system that seems like it has so much inertia for other water rights or existing, in the case of indigenous water rights, treaties and settlements that have not been followed.
Yeah, I'm happy to
take
an initial stab. And I will say, I litigated for several years before I shifted over to academia a few years ago, and I did that in part because the law is supposed to be all about justice, and the actual application of it sometimes results in the complete opposite, right? It is not this perfect system at all. I mean, look at our history, right? The way we treated women and slaves, they were not people. And if you read the old cases involving tribes, they were like barely people, right? I mean, I always seem to wear my t-shirts. I first listened to savages. That's how our Declaration of Independence refers to indigenous people in this country. And we've changed from that, right? People have rights now, women not quite treated equally, but kind of getting there. But that's movement. Look how long that took to get that movement. That was like 100 years, right? And so the law is not a fast system generally to affect change. But at the same time, I also don't think that, like, you have to work in the legal system. You're kind of forced to it. And there have been discussions about, the time that the compact was entered into, 1922, not just the compact, but just this whole doctrine of prior appropriation, that was at a time when we weren't worried about climate change, when supply was abundant, and we were able to meet everybody's needs. And so does that law make sense anymore in a climate change world? Probably not. But are we going to kick out the compact tomorrow? Are we going to totally change law prior appropriation? It's not going to happen overnight. Will there be some shifts over time? Maybe. I think there's been some interesting reporting and discussions happening out of California about their state law prior appropriation and the discriminatory, like, effects it's had on Black farmers and others. So I think we need to keep pushing at it. And again, baby steps have happened in Salt Lake, on the Great Salt Lake. Very baby steps. We had our governor, conference on the Great Salt Lake just 2 weeks ago, and the governor came and he's like, I'm not going to make goals about, because those are too out there. Well, how do you make progress if you don't have goals to measure against, right? But the recognition of even having the governor at a conference like that, that's a step we have to acknowledge. So I think we have to keep pushing at it. Lawsuits still have to happen. But that's the flip, is I think, again, trying to also help the general public, who probably isn't going to be engaging in a lawsuit. And again, I'm like, vote, 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 because votes have power. But aside that, right, they're not probably going to be lobbying. And so what can the average Utah, what can the average basin resident, however broad your purpose is, what can they do as an individual, I think, is to also key in. And
yeah, I want to actually ask Leah a similar question, but kind of tailored to the Great Salt Lake. And the idea of setting goals, I guess, because a lot of water world is negotiations and, you know, kind of voluntary agreements, and those can be really useful, but I'm curious if you think that's enough or there needs to be kind of specific policies, specific goals set out for something that's as kind of expansive as the crisis is unfolding that Great Salt Lake.
So Utah doesn't really like mandates.
Neither does
that. I don't think there's like political appetite for mandates. So we had a Democratic senator try to do something similar like they did at Mona Lake, which is set a target elevation for the Great Salt Lake to rise to. But we can see in Mona Lake, even though they have that target elevation in 20 years, it's not a problem. So it's complicated. What they did do, though, is set a salinity trigger, which is pretty similar to having mandated elevation. So if the salinity gets too high, then the mineral companies can't draw water, which they evaporate and turn into all kinds of metals or fertilizers and things. So they would have to stop doing that. We have a railroad, like a Rockville Railroad, that bisects the lake, such that that's an issue too. So they would fill that in and just kind of leave the north half to go super salty, and all the, you know, the ecosystem dies off, and we're serving south. So, I mean, they have done, yeah, they have done some things, but I think the other big thing that they're hoping for is that they overhaul our water law so that farmers can now lease water to the state for environmental use, like the Great Salt Lake. But I think the challenge is because these laws are so old, and people are so used to them, and water is so valuable, and everybody's just nervous about it being taken away. It's just going to take a long time to get people on board and to feel secure with doing something like that. So it would be nice if we'd been doing all this all like 10 years ago, but at least we're doing something.
Yeah. Bree, I want to ask you, yes, you know, the same sort of question, which is what levers of action, I guess, are the most effective? Do you see the law as being one avenue, policy changes in a more statutory way, or what sort of the, or in a kind of voluntary coalition work?
Well, in Idaho, and it's so interesting, these different states and territories and areas that the group of the four of us work in and around. That an interesting thing about Idaho, and it's relevant to your question, is I mentioned the Snake River earlier, but the Snake is, the headwaters are in Wyoming. It is the border between Oregon and Idaho, and goes up into southern Washington, southeast Washington. But the Snake is pretty much all in Idaho. And so Idaho doesn't have the same issue that the Colorado does. Or even the Columbia, I mean, our river is tributary to the Columbia, but the Columbia is different too. Idaho pretty much gets to say what happens to the Snake River, because it's pretty much all in Idaho. And around, I think it's around 80 or maybe even like 85% of water in all of the watersheds in Idaho ends up in the Snake, whether it comes from groundwater or is tributary to. So that's really the issue in this state, is how the Snake is used and managed. A couple things to know about that, you know, my perspective would be it's heavily managed. It is managed in a way that doesn't allow it to provide any of like its inherent values, I think, as far as being a river and flowing to all the people downstream that may or may not need it for different reasons or important creatures. At any rate, a couple things to know about the Snake. It is managed from the state's perspective. Our state policy, and it actually is in law, is that the Snake River is actually two rivers. There's the Snake River from the headwaters down to what's called the Milner Dam, and then people are familiar with where Twin Falls is. It's a little southeast of where we are now. And so the state of Idaho manages the river in a way so that it can be diverted completely and fully, so that it starts again below that dam at Milner Dam, just upstream of Twin Falls, and then it fills back in through all these springs that and a couple of different tributaries that fill in that mean that there's a river south of where we are just sitting right now. So that's one thing about how we manage it, and the state did do that through creating a policy and then putting it into law, which says it can be managed that way. And as Daniel said earlier, every state gets to manage its water how it chooses. I mean, there certainly are federal overlays, but state water law is different state to state. And so one of the things we don't have in Idaho, like I noted, Leah said that there's a rule now or law that allows people to donate back for like the health of the lake, perhaps. So in Idaho, if you're able to conserve more water, then you are allocated through your water right, because your water right was 150 years old and you don't actually need the amount of water that you did then to meet the same need because of improvements in infrastructure. You can't donate that back. There's a disincentive. I mean, you can donate it back, but you can sell it. There are a handful of what are called water banks where people are able, if they don't need their water a certain season or for multiple seasons, you can donate it into the state. It's managed by the state, and then people can rent it out or lease it out. The words are the opposite of what I think they are. Like, when you lease in and rent out, or rent in and lease out, and it's not what I ever think it's supposed to be. But there is a system in place, and there are numerous ones that are sort of quasi-tied to geography, depending on where you are in the state. You know, that whole upper snake so that's more geography. So you could lease water in way down near Milner Dam and take it out way upstream. So it's not exactly, it's not exactly like one for one on water. But we don't, as state law, there's been real resistance. There is no policy and there's no law that allows you to donate water back and have it committed to in-stream uses of water, to water quality, to fisheries, or even for aesthetic or other purposes. That doesn't exist. And it would be great if it would. I think that, from my perspective, and from ICL's perspective, it would, because those are the values that we stand for. But in many people's eyes, I think it's just, there's fear, because this is this thing that they have, this right to use water. It's valuable in the sense of if you're using it for ag, which is, again, I'm not normally like a stats person, but I guess like these are the things where I know some stats. I think it's like 82% of water rights in Idaho are for agriculture, and so being consumptively used. And as I just said, there's no mechanism that allows you to, if you've improved your infrastructure, which no doubt people have, because it's been 100 years in a lot of instances, you can't give it back. You can't give it back and maintain the value. And so there's a real disincentive to do that. And then I will stop in just a second. But the other thing I want to say about it is, in Idaho, the biggest sort of fight over water, because agriculture is the biggest user, is in the agricultural community. And it's between surface water users of water and groundwater users. So people may or may not know, but the Eastern Snake Plain Aquifer is one of the largest soil source aquifers in the nation. It's drinking water for a lot of people. A whole lot of rural communities in Idaho get well water from there. But it's also where, because as Idaho was developed after the Bureau of Reclamation, which I'll just say as someone who grew up in Tennessee had never heard of the Bureau of Reclamation. That was an irrelevant thing where I grew up, and it rained all the time, and there was tons of water. But as soon as I moved west, I learned what it was. As the snake was developed, people began to live further out on the plain and have access to water. That water moves out on the plain to irrigate the desert, essentially. Communities develop, farms develop, and then what happened in this state is about mid-20th century, you see like the advent of pumps, like the ability to go deep into the ground and electrically pump up water, and then that allows people to irrigate even more. And then what happened, really like the crux in Idaho, is toward the latter part of the 20th century, people with those wells began realizing that they were having to go deeper to get water, and people that had rights to use water. And when I say people, it's primarily agriculture, so big farms, small farms and big farms, began to realize that like these springs that used to fill up the river south of Twin Falls were just vastly less water, less volume of water. So it was like, what's going on? Well, what happened was it got way over appropriated. And there's a really cool graph, and I'll see if I can get it into the Hoover app later, just for anybody that's interested in seeing. It's somehow somebody figured out, again, I'm not a scientist or a statistician, but somebody figured out to have like three sides of the graph that show three different things. And what it shows basically is the volume of water in the Eastern St. Clair Aquifer around 1900. All the way to about 2010, and you see it go up, and then you see it go way back down, and then you look at the river flows at the same time. That created a whole crisis situation that is still playing out now, and as recently as last summer, actually, the groundwater users of water, which are inherently the junior users in Idaho, were not getting all their water because of climate change and drought. But the surface water users and the groundwater users, an agreement they hammered out about 7-8 years ago, it was not working because of climate change and drought. And so we're sort of back at that place again where we once were. And I think what's sort of interesting, especially from the conservation perspective of doing this work in Idaho, is that that's the biggest issue. And that's where all the air in the room is. That's where all the energy or any like public will or like elected public will is to address that problem. But it's related to over appropriation for people. It's not related to drinking water. It's not related to fisheries. It's not related to tribal rights, of which we have numerous tribes in Idaho that have very old and some of the most senior rights in the state. But that's not where it goes here, and that's all politics. Sorry, so I know.
Yeah, I think that's a great point with water. Like, it does seem like there are these kind of crisis management modes where all of the air just gets, and attention and energy just gets sucked into this one area of just like fixing the crisis at hand and not necessarily any other considerations. I'm going to ask one quick question, and then I'm going to open up to audience questions. But one thing I thought was really interesting is you all mentioned kind of water quality and public health issues in your sort of opening discussions about how you approach these issues. And yeah, so I found a similar thing in my reporting. So I can't speak to Utah, but in Nevada, the water quality section of the state, they're in the same Natural Resources Agency, but the water quality people are totally separate from the water quantity people. It's all sorts of issues, especially around mining. But I'm kind of curious how, if you have kind of some brief advice for journalists, how they can approach these issues so they're focusing on more holistic kind of article, not necessarily just the water quantity part, but also some of these issues around public health, whether that's from dust or from water quality issues or just access issues. So I'll just pose that question and we can start with that.
Yeah, I think that's really a great question. Because in environmental health, right, like from the public standpoint, it used to be very much focused on physical. What's the physical ailment here? Is, you know, this dust contributing to asthma, things like that. And then over the years, it expanded to incorporate the mental health component, and then tribal realm, you know, kind of this spiritual and cultural component as well. And so, like, on the books, it's there, and I think it also reflects the different silos that we operate in, that in the legal lawsuits, like a lot of times we're not turning to the literature that is out there on health research, and it's there. There's research out there, again, data challenges with indigenous peoples for sure, but there are studies that have looked at the mental health and suicide prevention of students who are engaging out in the environment, like, right, like a lot of research, non-tribes on, are connect for recreation and just being out in nature and the positive impact that can have on health. And then, you know, the indigenous way of thinking is you need to close that loop, right? So yes, we get these benefits from nature, but then we also need to be better stewards, and it creates this kind of cycle. So that's, I think there's this overarching lens there. Look, you know, you may be doing a study on this one lawsuit and they're making this one argument, but look, make sure you're looking at the other disciplines, because we don't pull together on our own, and there is a lot of supporting work being done. Yeah, the law review articles, but then like the public health researchers, like the social workers, even like, so just look more widely, I'd say, and then apply the indigenous way of knowledge that it's just more circular, right? It's not just a one-way take, it's this achieving balance and long-term planning. And then I think, you know, so yeah, the nature impacts benefits we have, then it turns back around of the stewardship that we have back to the environment.
Well, Utah has all kinds of air quality problems, not just the lake. We have this thing called an inversion in the winter, which is just terrible. It's just smog for weeks. And then in the summer, we have ozone pollution. So I think the lake also posing this danger of dust pollution, and people are very aware of the health issues that they face. But I think that it's just overwhelming to people, and they kind of tune out. So what we have tried to do as the Great Salt Lake Collaborative is present solutions. Like we're not all screwed, you guys. Like, there are things we could do. Here's what we learned from Owens Lake and how they engineered the lake so the dust stopped, right? Or we could do what they did at Mono Lake, like a target elevation. Or we did a big series where the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I don't know if you've heard of them, but they're a big player in Utah. So we did a big series on like what they could do. They have a lot of cultural sway in our state. They own a lot of land, which means they own a lot of water. And a lot of the recommendations that we put out there, they've actually done. My surprise. They donated 20,000 acre feet to the lake. First time the lake has ever been able to say, like, own water. Like, the lake owns that water. That's the first. They have call on people that, you know, their sprinklers are running in the middle of the day when there's, like, water restrictions, that call us and complain. Like, we're okay with that. We're going to stop. They're going to xeriscape their temple property. So I think, yeah, that's my answer. Just maybe not always dealing with public health around, but offer solutions.
I'm not sure I have much to add, but I would say, and I know I said it in my intro, that here in Idaho, water is managed from a quality and quantity perspective by two very different entities and bodies, and they are, when you speak with them, not on the record. Yeah. You know, they're pretty open about the fact that that causes problems in it, from a public health perspective. I mean, that's not always the conversation that we're having with agency colleagues, but it certainly does. And I think that then looking to the other entities, as Heather said, that that might have a say in the matter, could be a helpful thing. So here in Idaho, we've been talking to the Department of Health and Welfare or to the public health districts in different parts of the states about what's happening to the water in those communities and why nothing's being done about it in a lot of instances. And it's like each side is like, hands are tied, like we've done what we can, but we can't make them do anything. And they're like, well, we can't make more water be here, so we can't do that.
Awesome. Yeah, those are really, I think, all helpful tips. And I want to open it up to audience questions if there are some. Okay, good. They did give me some direction, so I will just say, if you could identify yourself, your name and affiliation, that would be great. And just since we do have limited time, I also told them we have to be out of here right at 12 and try to get to the next session. So if you could just sort of keep your questions somewhat brief. But I know, you know, I recognize some people in this room, and I know a lot of people have some really good insights into this issue. So I'm looking forward to the questions. So we'll start right there.
Hi, my name is Eric Guys, and I'm an independent journalist and the author of a recent book, Water Always Wins, Thriving in the Age of Drought and Deluge. And it's really about like changing the culture of our relationship with water, because of the dominant culture, it's very much like your threat or a commodity, and it has that very single focus lens, but many cultures around the world, instead view water more holistically, like that involves the sustainability. And I just have a site op-ed out in Scientific American yesterday about the Colorado River Basin and all of the kind of slow water approaches to rehydrating the landscape that is like more of an abundance mindset instead of a scarcity mindset. So a lot of what you said was resonating with that, and like the link between surface water and groundwater. I do have a question, which is, you know, some places around the world, like Australia and Kenya, have a water right system that is, like, there may be people who get preferential, you know, more water, but when there's a drought, they share the pain, right? So it's not that, like, somebody continues to get their full allotment and somebody else gets nothing. And so I'm wondering, like, this new, position from the Biden administration regarding the possibility of Arizona and California having to equally decrease water. I'm wondering if that could be an impetus to inspire Western states to overhaul their water rights system by fire
prevention. Yeah, I mean, right, it's so fascinating that no one wants to give, and so I think they're going to be forced to, and that's where you get people in. States can't come up with a plan. Could this be the push? Maybe, maybe not. Who knows? This is all unprecedented. What I'll say is challenging is I agree with it. Like, everyone needs to come to the table. The status quo just doesn't work. It's set up on a failed system. But I guess my issue with that comes to when it comes out of the tribes, because it's really unfair and inequitable to say the tribes, hey, you have to take a cut too, when they have never been able to fully utilize their rights, and everybody else has that economic gain on the back of their not inability to use. And so that, like, I agree with it. Yes, everybody needs to set that tribal piece, because we've never rectified it. And it's hard, right? Because as you saw in that figure, the tribal interest and portion of like Arizona is big. And so, but, you know, again, I think honestly, right, as long as we're talking about money and this being a commodity, well, then tribes need to be the same as the farmers, right? They can, yeah, they can lease their rights, they can not use it, but you need to pay them the way we've been paying the farmers for the past decade, right? And the $4 billion that's going out for drought resiliency by, you know, one of the first things they put out, the money used was for farmers to not use. So I agree, like, this is unprecedented, we all have to give and take, and it's the same as settlement, like, attorney mindset. You just don't get win-wins in disagreements, right? The best settlement negotiation, and this isn't just environment, but anything, is when everybody comes around to, like, okay, but they didn't get everything they want. So I think that plays in what's going to happen, but I think there's this injustice we have to do to tribes so that they're, equal levels, and then they can contribute, right? And Rick and Gila River, right, being in a better position to be able to engage in that form, right? They're being paid for contributing to conservation. I could go on, but I know we have other questions, so.
I quickly would add that I don't see Idaho doing it. Idaho's not going to change its water rights system anytime soon. Just deep entrenched resistance and fear, I think. And again, as I said earlier, since the snake is primarily within Idaho, and other states aren't really in a position to tell the elected leadership of Idaho that they need to change it, I don't see it happening. The one other thing, though, I did want to say on this is I've had some really interesting experiences in my work where there have been certain proposals for water, and I've gotten to travel to other parts of the state and go and, you know, meet with the folks proposing it. And twice I have been out on farms or ranches with for part of the time with, you know, multiple generations, with like a dad and a grown child looking at a project. And when the dad, essentially the granddad or the great-granddad, left, this happened two different times a few years apart, the person who was more maybe like my age here was like, I see the future changing. I know it's not always going to be the way it's been. I can't say that to him. He won't listen. But I want to stay here. I want to live here. I want to raise my family here. And so I recognize that I have to think differently. And that just has always stayed with me. It gives me some hope for the way that, you know, people are coming around. But don't expect Idaho to follow what the rest of the country does when it comes to coming up with a more equitable plan for shared water.
Yeah, well, and I had Arizona farmers say, I'm going to do what pays the most.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know.
I just want to add really quickly that Nevada, there was a groundwater management plan in Nevada that deviated from prior appropriations, strict prior appropriation, and applied shortages, so it applies shortages to everybody on a percentage basis. The Nevada Supreme Court said that that was allowed under the groundwater management plan statute. Now there's an effort in the legislature to change the groundwater management plan statute so it doesn't happen again. So it is definitely something that is embedded, and really there's a lot of deep kind of opinions and fears and attitudes around. And so it's an interesting topic. Are there other questions? Over there.
My name is Benjamin Jones. I'm with Vox, and I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about how this past winter's rainfall and snowfall is affecting discussions around changing or coming up with a new way to divvy up the water, if it's taking urgency out of these conversations in a bad way, or if it's giving more time that will ultimately be good. Like, how is it shaping the conversation?
Yeah, thank goodness we had better snow, because I thought I would spend the whole year, the cold coming year, just writing about the ecological collapse. I think our lawmakers, our governor, are aware that one winter is not enough. I think it's our role as reporters and as a Great Salt Lake Collaborative to drive that message home to our readers and to our communities, because I think there are, you already do hear that shift in attitude that, like, oh, the lake's going to fill now. So we've been, like, really trying to use, like, graphics and images to just drive home the point that, yes, the lake went up, but it's going to go back down, and it really needs to get here before we're in the clear.
And I'll say Idaho is right there in it with a huge water year. I am concerned that it's going to take the urgency. I'm hearing that some. I was in sort of just listened in on a conversation among the big water group, the water users I referenced earlier, sort of the surface water versus groundwater groups, just earlier this week, and you could just feel that, you could hear it. I mean, it being literally said, like, oh, okay, well, we don't have to worry as much right now, and so I'm pretty concerned. Although I'm hopeful that, especially like in some states where there's further negotiations along, that it won't, and that people will lose this time. But
yeah, I wonder if it's more of like a local on a local level, that when you're looking at a local system, people are like, oh, wow, this rain, and then the urgency has been released. But say on the basin, I don't think that's happened, because the studies are like new, but I think everyone's really clear this is not going to solve the problem. And so on the wider systems, which is good, right? And then, but you also have like renegotiations coming up, no matter what, and plans coming out. So I think there are other factors that we, the event for the basin is continuing to be a factor of importance. But locally, yeah, maybe for the local reporters, it's really important that you connect back in the science.
Yeah, and I think it's something that the West has dealt with over and over. If you haven't seen it, there's this chart that shows the hydrological cycle of, you know, panic to rain to slope to despair. So it's worth, that's worth looking at. Are there more?
Yeah, I have a question about municipal use. I feel like one thing you hear a lot from municipal boosters is that there's plenty of water for municipal growth. You still have a chart. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm Jacob and Chris, and we really appreciate the shout out. There's lots of water and agricultural users, you know, crit come a lot in Arizona. I guess my question is, do you think that given the constrictions of water law and the durability of prior appropriation, that transition can actually be affected, you know, in our existing legal system, sort of act to municipal use transition that a lot of the city about?
I'm trying to think. That was RAFN. I was trying to remember what this acronym means. Like, reasonably anticipated future need. I think, of water that's part of Idaho's water law. Anyway, I can't speak to other states, but that is an element of water law of this state that allows municipalities to plan for growth into time, and so you can get a water right for a RAFN, it's called a RAFN right, recently anticipated future need, and because of the growth you anticipate. And I just want to put one other thing on that, though, in this valley. So this is the part of Idaho's growing. This, you are in the part of Idaho that is growing the most. This is called the Treasure Valley. To the west of where we're sitting is where the primary growth is. And so we have a lot of agricultural lands that are turning into now, you know, like annexed municipal use, residences, things of that nature. There has been no change in water use, and that really gets back to that sort of like fear that I think so many people have. You know, their water right may be the most monetarily valuable thing they own, and or they have a right to, and they there's a real resistance. And so right now we have the same amount of water going to the west here in this valley as it ever did since infrastructure was built to do it, even though the need has completely changed. And that is enshrined in law to make sure that that doesn't change. That's a real problem that we have. And so what's happening in this valley right now is the Boise River has three large dams, and it's, as you go upstream, one of the largest of them, the Anderson Ranch Dam, is currently slated for an elevation. It's like, it's either 450 or 490 feet tall. It is going to get 10 additional feet added to it. So what this valley is doing is, instead of any conservation measures being put in place to address growth, we are spending hundreds of millions of dollars raising a dam by 10 feet that may or may not fill in. So we're doing that here. That has been the decision. And it's, you probably can tell it's maddening to me that that's what's happening. But that is how this valley is managing growth, even though there's a mechanism within the law to be able to address it.
Director of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, who had a lot of who proposed a pipeline to the Mississippi back in, I don't know, I think the 2000s when the drought was really getting bad on the Colorado River. I haven't covered a lot of NEPA processes. I have a difficulty imagining what an EIS would look like for, transnational pipeline. And I think there's some, I don't know what the cost would be. So Arizona, and I don't know as much about this, actually does have an augmentation sort of committee or agency that is looking at ideas for augmenting the Colorado River. I know that when the Central Arizona Project was first approved back in the 60s, yeah, okay, thank you. When it was first approved back in the 60s, they looked at augmenting the Colorado River with the Columbia River. So it's not a new idea, but I think that most people that I've interviewed in the basin agree that the idea of becoming more dependent on an outside source is really not the path forward for the Colorado River, that the basin really needs to figure out a way to use less water. And I think Vegas is a good example of the sort of change in attitude there. In addition to, and they didn't seriously, there was no like formal proposal for the Mississippi pipeline, but the same general manager of the Water Authority of Vegas did propose a pipeline in Las Vegas to ship rural groundwater kind of 250 miles into Vegas, and they have shelved that proposal completely to double down on conservation, which I think is kind of where the basin is headed in general.
Another kind of ludicrous idea that popped up in our legislature this past session was cutting down trees, like cutting down forests and more water streams or something. Yeah. So I haven't spent a lot of time debunking that. But I think it just goes to this point that we look for like these easy solutions, so it takes the responsibility off of me and my water use. So, like it's someone else's problem, like people building the pipeline, like they can take care of it, Forest Service can take care of it. So I think as reporters in the West, it's important for us to drive home these messages that it's there's not like one big easy answer that's gonna solve the problems. Yeah.
Why this is kind of news, and I'm based in Phoenix, and I want to go back to municipal use because I was talking to a lot of Valley cities, and the tone I'm getting in the direct quotes I'm getting is that growth pays for growth, and though they all recognize that we may have less water than the Colorado River, we will do what it takes to find new sources of water and keep growing, basically. And I'm curious to hear from like across the West how if similar ideas are playing out, because it's definitely happening in Arizona and the Valley, and other places are also talking the same way that sure, Colorado might be drying up, but water can be found elsewhere if you have the money for it.
Yeah, but I think it probably depends, the state with us. Because Nevada, the little trickle side is bucket, limiting pool sizes, doing all sorts of laws that Utah could be doing, or all these other states could be doing that, and they're not. And so at some point, I think those states that are keep allowing this, uncapped growth are going to have to do measures like that. But again, driving our back, we're not limiting it right now. There's no legal basis, that's been tested to limit where you live in that development. But there was another. Oh, but I do think push comes to shove, right? Because the Interior, I think it was, when they were saying, we're not going to cut off water to Phoenix homes. So if we do allow this development at some point, going back to that prior thing, that may be that turn where the municipal domestic use gets elevated above. Because again, the societal values, I think, are driving this.
I would add that in the Great Salt Lake Basin, some of our communities on the Wasatch Back that are rapidly growing, as people, especially after the pandemic, right, people are moving back there, below the mountains, they have run out of water and they're building moratoriums. So people haven't been able to build their second home or, the house. So these shortages are playing out, and like either we can plan for this, or the lack of water can force us to reckon with it, I guess.
And I would say here, it's like growth pace for growth, I don't think that I hear that as much, but I think that as rapidly as this valley is growing and as little water as we have, there's not that much of a concern, in part because of what I was saying earlier. There's really a lot of water considering, even though we get 13 inches of precip a year. But excuse me. One thing I did want to say, and people may be aware of this, but the, every 5 years the U.S. Geologic Survey does their national evaluation analysis of water use in the United States. And the last two times, Idaho has been number one for domestic use, use per capita. So this is water that we use in.
We're number two.
I was going to say, and used to, Utah was. Arizona has been up there. Nevada has been up there. Idaho has, very unproudly been the top of the list the last two times. And the issuance of the report, I think, got thrown off a little bit by COVID. A new one is due any time. But there is, what I always say about that is, I was like, Utah used to be on the top of it, and they got down. Like, we can make great progress. And so I think that is just emblematic of the fact that we do have enough water to accommodate the needs, the daily needs of human beings in this valley in particular. And again, that's half the people in Idaho, right around where we are. So I don't see that being, you just don't hear that so much right here, because the truth is, if we decide as a state, if we get the collective will to implement some measures at all on how people are able to use water in and around their homes, there's enough here.
So we are running up right to about 12 o'clock, but I just wanted to ask our panelists if you guys have any kind of closing remarks that you want to make, or tips for journalists in covering some of these issues and thinking about some of these water issues in a more holistic way.
Yeah,
that's
good. So one of the other things that we use is Indigenous Women's Leadership Network. So we cover on the Colorado River and we're trying to do tribes, right? I'm sure the same five names are often. Did you talk to Derek? Did you talk to Nicole? Did you talk to Norm, right? People who are known for being willing to talk for words. And one of the things we're trying to do is increase that and support versus women in the basin. But anyway, point is, we're trying to increase the number of tribal emerging established leaders who are feeling comfortable to talk on these issues. And so one of the things, as a reporter, we share new contexts, again, I think just as my tip of like new people who have not talked to the media before, is it helps, and I think one of the responses, if you give them that sense in sharing the questions. And I know I have rarely had reporters give me back my lines to approve, and I know there's different rules on that, but if it's a newer Indigenous person, you may be more likely than maybe more comfortable if you're showing them what you're going to print, and then you can establish that relationship with them. Not to say that's something we're working on. We're trying to get more people comfortable, because that viewpoint, I think, is really important.
I think the water shortages and issues we're facing has really created this urban and rural divide. I think a lot of city dwellers like to point to farmers and alfalfa especially and blame them for all our problems, but they don't then look at themselves and how much beef they eat every day, or cheese, I love cheese. So I think I, at least as a reporter, try really hard to bridge that gap and help people understand that. And also, I mean, because I think even the farmers will look at the cities and be like, well, they're the ones using all the water, and like, don't come for me. So that's something you can do.
And I can't imagine that I have anything that, other than thank you all so much. I just appreciate that people are interested in covering these issues. It's incredibly important, and without media covering them, none of us would be aware. We wouldn't know at all. So I just really appreciate the interest that each of you have and everyone here at this conference. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you all so much, and thanks for the great questions.